Better retail sales indicate an improving economy.
Is it time for the Fed to change its interest rate tune?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, December 13th.
All right, here are some other questions we're going to try to answer. Did Europe's supposed debt crisis solution create a whole new problem?
Just how important is that holiday gift?
And what happened to the $60 million a guy at a slot machine in Austria was told he won?
Uh-oh, that doesn't sound good at all.
It doesn't have a happy
ending. Find out just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Federal Reserve today is holding a short meeting and will likely later announce interest rates are going to remain near zero. Now, the Fed's kept borrowing costs low to spur economic growth, especially during these darker economic times. But Marketplace's Scott Tong reports the Fed may have an exit strategy for its bargain basement rates.
If you believe surveys of economists who watch the Fed, central bankers may eventually abandon their economic steroid policy. The Fed has kept interest rates ultra low and telegraphed they'd continue to do so for the next year and a half. So why back off? Well, the U.S. economy is showing some signs of life, says Steve Barrow at Standard Bank in London.
Things have been a little better in the last couple of months. Growth in the fourth quarter of this year could be 3% or more.
The economic hopeful camp thinks at the next meeting in January, the Fed may signal publicly that interest rates will eventually come off the floor. But policymakers are split. Some still see weaknesses and think the Fed needs to buy large amounts of mortgage securities.
The aim of this type of quantitative easing is not just to have lower rates, but it's also to put some extra cash in the economy.
As always, there's juicy conjecture, but the Fed next month may take away some of the parlor game fun. It plans to be more transparent in its communications and its leanings. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Let's get some analysis now and bring in former Fed economist Gary Schilling, who joins us from Springfield, New Jersey. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, do you think that we're at a turning point here, that the Fed may decide to end its zero interest rate policy, not right away, but at least they'll say they're going to do it sooner than we thought?
I'm not sure they're going to do anything right now. With the crisis in Europe, they may be reluctant to make any change. But the one thing they are shifting toward was what I would call phase three of monetary policy. They first reduced interest rates. That really didn't bring the economy back to honey and roses. Then they went in for this quantitative easing, buying a lot of treasury securities and mortgage-related securities. That really didn't do the job. And the third phase, I think I'd call jawboning. I think they're out of bullets. Right now, they're concentrating on communications, if you will.
Well, explain the choice that they face. What is the effect going to be when they finally do decide to raise interest rates?
Well, it wouldn't have much effect in itself because it probably would be following a much stronger economy. In other words, it would be more the effect than the cause. I don't see the Fed doing that in a vacuum, not in an economy, and particularly a global economy, as weak as it is today.
I want to just finally take you back to a few years ago when they did put in this zero interest rate policy. Did you ever think that 3 years later we'd still be in the same place?
It took three decades to leverage up, to in effect go through tremendous excess borrowing by U.S. consumers, by the financial sector globally, and it takes a long time to unwind that. And that's the good news. If it were unwound in a year or so, we'd have a depression that would make the 1930s look like a Sunday school picnic.
Former Fed economist Gary Schilling joining us from Springfield, New Jersey. Thanks so much.
You're most welcome.
The government said this morning retail sales jumped last month for the sixth straight month. Americans, Jeremy, spent more on cars, clothing, and furniture, and they spent less on building materials, gasoline, and groceries.
Makes sense about the gasoline. I filled up the tank yesterday, and it was a little bit cheaper than it has been in recent
days. I've been noticing that myself, yes.
And this is where we will start now with Julie Nieman, analyst at Smith, Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So six straight months of increases in retail sales. What do you make of that?
Well, everything's a little more modest than expected. We're going shopping, but we're having lunch at home before we go or dining out under the arches. And we're being smart. We're spending within our means. We're using savings. We're not piling on debt. And we're really still concerned about wage growth because there's no real wage growth. And we're really concerned about employment as well. Job growth is likely to slow down early next year. And bargain buying is the key thing because you're having demanding discounts. Stores are even refunding price differences. That really clipped Best Buy. They took it on the chin for that reason. But it looks like Black Friday after Thanksgiving was probably the high water mark for this season's retail sales.
And Julie, the Fed is starting a meeting today and finishing a meeting today. They're going to come out with some notes and an announcement today, this afternoon. Do you think that they'll look at this stuff, this latest data, and see an improving economy and say it's time to end the zero interest rate policy?
Well, I think they're going to see that the past moves are finally having some effect. After 4 years of flooding the system with easy money, 0% interest rates, and the banks still didn't lend, they're fearful the economy would turn again and they'd be caught with all next round of bad loans. But in March, they started lending again, and it's up nearly 5% since then. And this is another sign that we're crawling to recovery here, and it is led by small businesses, which is always the pattern. But the Fed doesn't want to squash the growth, and they still have an eye on Europe, so they're going to stamp the minutes of the meeting ND, nothing done.
Julie Neiman, analyst at Smithmore and Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will give a big speech at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today. He's pitching Iraq as a place to do business, a good place to do business. But is he right? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
Iraq is expected to spend $100 billion repairing its creaking infrastructure, hiring construction companies and engineers. Lionel Johnson is the Chamber of Commerce's Middle East expert.
They need homes. They need power generation. They need to have roads and bridges.
Johnson says Iraq has a growing middle class. He expects eventually they'll start wanting iPhones and Pepsi. The chamber has been holding workshops on Iraq around the country. Pharmacist Jim Seymour went to one in the Seattle area.
We're still in the thinking stage.
There is certainly a lot to think about in Iraq. Security, bureaucracy, paperwork. Still, Seymour knows his wrinkle creams would sell there.
Any woman that's in her middle ages would want these products. And if they had a choice, they would certainly go after them.
Other countries are already going after Iraqi consumers. France, which opposed the Iraq war, has more investments there than the U.S. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Business groups in Illinois are pushing lawmakers today to pass a $330 million package to keep two companies in the land of Lincoln.
They're Sears and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which, Jeremy, you'd think would have to change its name if it left the state of Illinois.
Maybe that's why they're the CME group, so that nobody knows. They could be, Cleveland or...
Or Continental.
Continental, exactly.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now the Marketplace global perspective. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso said today it's unfortunate the UK didn't go along with its EU neighbors on a plan for budget accountability.
Well, meanwhile, some economists say those new stringent measures to rein in spending could actually make things worse. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Europe calls it a fiscal union. It will compel governments to balance their books, largely by cutting their spending. But Paul McNamara of the fund management firm GAM says the axe will fall at the worst possible time for Europe.
This reduced government spending looks set to come at the same time as banks tighten up and they reduce private sector spending. And that kind of constitutes a double whammy to growth.
And this could be a disaster for the debt-laden countries of Europe.
The worst thing that you can do when you're excessively indebted is to not grow.
Sony Kapoor of a think tank called Redefine says if an economy fails to grow, governments collect less tax but have to spend more on unemployment benefits.
If you don't grow, your debt will keep on becoming worse and you have to run faster and faster to stand still.
But the Germans, who are the driving force behind the fiscal union, say Europe has got to deal with its debt, and not just Europe. Alexander Graf Lambsdorff, a German lawmaker, says a new age is dawning and Europe is leading the way.
I believe in Europe we are a little bit ahead of the United States in having realized that the age of eternal debt and over-indebtedness has come to an end.
Lambsdorff says that big democratic governments in the US, Japan and Europe have been gorging on debt for too long. They've been bribing their voters with goodies which they can no longer afford.
Our entitlement programs will have to be cut. Pension systems are under strain. Our healthcare is going to deteriorate if we do not turn this around and return to a system in which the money that you spend is money you've earned before.
But critics of Europe's planned fiscal union say if the continent relies only on austerity, there will be a new age, one of permanent recession. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, now to Russia, where tens of thousands of people have been protesting what they see as fraud-tainted elections.
Yeah, and where now Vladimir Putin has a new opponent for the March presidential elections. It's billionaire Mikhail Prokhorov, who happens to own, Jeremy, as you know, the New Jersey Nets.
Indeed he does. For more on him, we turn to Bill Browder, who's CEO of the Russian hedge fund Hermitage Capital. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, tell us about this guy, Mikhail Prokhorov. Where did he get all his money?
Well, he was one of the original 22 oligarchs who was involved in the privatization of the sort of scandalous privatization of Russia. And his particular deal was that he got control, along with one other fellow, of one of the largest nickel mines in the world called Norilsk Nickel. And through that came billions and billions of dollars worth of dividends, and then he eventually sold his stake to another oligarch and got billions and billions of dollars. He's now the second richest Russian, I believe, with roughly a net worth of $18 billion.
Is this sort of like Bill Gates or Michael Bloomberg deciding to run for president?
No, because those guys built their businesses. They didn't essentially get them nearly for free from the state. I don't know if you have any comparable examples in America of someone like that running for president.
Is this at all comparable to what's going on across the Arab world or even what's happening here in the United States with the middle class really looking for an alternative to the current power structure in the country?
Well, I think it's more comparable to what's going on in the Arab world than in America, because what you have in Russia is a very, very small group of people, maybe 10,000 people who are usurping all of the state resources through corruption schemes for their own economic benefit at the expense of 141 million Russians, so that the roads are all full of potholes, the hospitals don't save lives, and the schools don't educate their children to an extent that you can't even imagine coming from America. And so what people are angry about in Russia is that all the money has gotten stolen, and they're essentially it's being shoved down their throats to accept another 12 years of this, which is what people came out on Saturday to demonstrate against.
Bill Browder, CEO of Hermitage Capital, a Russian hedge fund. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, after the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan, there was a lot of talk about a shift away from nuclear energy. We may be seeing signs of that today.
The French nuclear giant Areva has just announced it's cutting jobs and closing plants in a $2 billion cost-cutting move. Christopher Worth has more from London.
Right about now, the nuclear industry was supposed to be in the middle of a renaissance. After decades of sluggish growth, hundreds of new reactors were being planned across the globe. The industry was pushing for governments, including in the U.S., to support new nuclear development. Areva had positioned itself to reap the benefits. The company sells everything from reactor designs to the uranium used to run them. But Cash Burchett, an industry analyst at IHS, says that all came to a halt with the Fukushima disaster in Japan earlier this year.
Since then, the key growth markets, both in Europe and in Asia, have become far less reliable. The phase-out of nuclear power in Germany, the suspension of projects in Switzerland and Italy are all really a function of Fukushima.
Areva says it will slash 1,500 jobs in Germany, and it's mothballing plans to build a $3 billion uranium enrichment plant in Idaho within 3 years. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
The people who make champagne are popping the top these days.
Hey.
International sales of bubbly is up by double digits over last year.
Simon Field is a champagne buyer for wine merchants Barry Brothers and Rudd, and he joins us now just outside of London in a town called Hampshire, England. Mr. Field, good morning to you.
Good morning.
I know the economy hasn't been a lot to celebrate. Why are people popping so much champagne these days?
It's amazing. You think the champagne would be a bellwether of the economy, and all the forecasts you hear at the moment, things are going from bad to worse. But in our company and in the UK as a whole, we've seen champagne sales rising. Over 10% increase in volume. I think it's 18% in our company, and even more by value. So to answer your question, I think I don't know whether it's to cure the depression, to cure the blues, or just because people are recognizing what fantastic value there can be in champagne.
The European debt crisis can't be making matters better, though, right? I mean, how do you forecast something like that?
It's difficult for the growers because they have to predict what the economy will be like 2 or 3 years after the harvest, because they have to keep the wine on its yeast for a minimum of 15 months. So they have to judge what their yields are going to be and judge what demand is going to be two years down the line. So it can be quite tricky.
And what are you thinking? I mean, what are you hearing about the demand?
I think demand is going up. They restricted yields quite dramatically, perhaps in a draconian fashion after the 2008 recession. But it looks, all the indication is that demand is going up.
Simon Field, the champagne buyer for Barry Brothers and Rudd. Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much.
Well, it is the holiday season, which for some Americans, Jeremy, means it's bonus time, right?
Yeah, some
bonus
Americans, but not
Americans.
Us. We'll get
maybe
a donut.
We don't even get a ham. Yeah, I don't even think we get a ham. would be nice. Yeah, there are hams around here, all right. My gosh. On Wall Street, of course, bankers and traders are bracing for their bonuses. And I say bracing because bonuses are likely to be much smaller this year. But as Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports, it's all relative.
It's bonus season on Wall Street. To anyone who works in finance, this one bonus payment will be a momentous validation or dismissal of an entire year's work. Michael Driscoll now teaches at Adelphi University, but he used to be a trader at Bear Stearns.
You know, face it, nobody goes to work on Wall Street because they're trying to cure cancer or work for the greater good of the common man. You go to Wall Street because you want to make a lot of money.
While there's less money available this year, banks have struggled to be profitable. Alan Johnson heads a firm that advises Wall Street on how to pay its people. He predicts that bonuses will be down by one-third this year. That would still net the average senior investment banker around $900,000. But don't call it a bonus.
The average person doesn't realize how much the word bonus has caused more pain than just about any word I can think about. We think of bonus as being a tip, a gratuity, extra. And for many people on Wall Street, it's most of their pay.
Richard Lipstein at Boyden Executive Search explains.
Someone made $1 million. It's likely that that person made maybe $200,000 in a base and $800,000 in a bonus.
And that $800,000 bonus wouldn't come in hard cash. Around 50 to 80% comes in the form of a bank's stock, and a banker may not be able to sell it for 3 years. But money with strings attached is better than no money at all. Most banks are laying people off. Morale is low, Driscoll says.
It makes for kind of a pall over the entire street.
Lipstein says layoffs are a bigger worry than the size of bonus checks this year.
A good number of people I talk to are almost happy to have a job.
Which makes Wall Street more like the rest of America for once. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
The state of Colorado today will decide whether to make energy companies list all the chemicals they use to do hydraulic fracturing for natural gas. But environmentalists want them to disclose much more. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
In public meetings, oil and gas companies say hydraulic fracturing does not pose significant risk. But Dusty Horwitt at the Environmental Working Group just led a six-month investigation on what those companies tell their investors. He found a different story.
Here you have them disclosing a long list of risks to shareholders, very severe risks, leaks, spills, explosions, a limited insurance coverage, bodily injury, death.
The law requires companies to list the most significant risks to their bottom line in annual financial reports. Horwitt says if shareholders are being warned, then landowners signing over their rights should be warned, too. Michael Giberson is with the Center for Energy Commerce at Texas Tech. He says this isn't a case of investors getting special treatment.
I think that that's kind of a stretch to try to make something out of this.
You know, the information about the risk is sort of widely available and known.
And he says the risks explained in financial reports are broad. Anyone approached by a drilling company should study the specific risks for themselves. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, have you been out to do any Christmas shopping yet?
I haven't yet. I'm probably going to wait until I go see my family.
Well, yeah, you know, it's always very hard to figure out what to get the person that you're shopping for and all of that, and whether you should spend a lot or spend a little or put a lot of thought into the gift or not.
Sure.
Well, there's actually some new research on that point, and we are going to hear about that now.
All right. In today's Midday Extra, we ask, why do we put so much effort into gifts during the holidays? Gabe Adams is a professor at the London Business School and a researcher on the study. Hey, Gabe.
Hi, how are you?
So, Gabe, basically, I can now get my friends and family bad gifts this year, and when they complain, I can tell them this is all about science.
Well, I wouldn't say bad gifts, but certainly you don't have to spend quite as much money as you would think on a gift for your family or friends.
I mean, why is that? Because I'm thinking about spending, let's say I drop $50 on a present for Jeremy, but I don't have to. I can spend maybe, you know, 12.
Well, it turns out that givers, people who are shopping for gifts this holiday season, think that the more money they spend on a gift, the more the gift will be appreciated. But the people who are receiving those gifts, so your loved ones, your family, your friends, don't actually appreciate gifts more when you spend more money on them.
So it's more about the giver's feelings than the recipient's.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Well, what about putting a lot of thought into a gift? What if I spend all day making Steve a new big house out of gingerbread, and I put a lot of different M&M's on it and chocolate chips and stuff like that? If I put a lot of time and effort in, does that help?
Yeah, that'll help. And certainly it's more about, putting time and thought into gifts. And that can actually save you a lot of money. You know, if you do, if you make a thoughtful handmade gift, the recipient might appreciate that a lot more. And that's a great way to save money, especially in these tough economic times that we're facing.
A good friend of mine in Alabama, actually, she would always make these handmade, you know, she'd make these boxes with bows, and she would put cookies and all kinds of sweets, and everybody would just appreciate it more. And I'd be like, boy, you got off scot easy, because all you did was make like a batch of chocolate chip cookies or sugar cookies or something like that, and then make some pretty boxes, and we would get into arguments. I want to know, Gabe, though, I'm curious about this. How did you guys figure this out? What kind of science did you really use?
Well, we actually did three studies on this. In one study, we asked people to imagine giving or receiving either a CD or an iPod as a gift. And it turns out that givers think that if they give an iPod, it will be more thoughtful and more appreciated than if they give a CD. But receivers appreciate the CD and the iPod more equally and think that they're equally thoughtful gifts.
Wow.
Where are they going to play the CD? That's a big question.
On their Walkman.
But it turns out that this actually also applies to engagement rings. And, you know, a lot of people give engagement rings over the holiday season. And we asked men who had recently purchased an engagement ring how much they'd spent on the ring and how much they thought their fiancé would appreciate it. And they thought that the more they had spent, the more that their fiancé would like it. But then we asked women who recently received engagement rings how much they liked their inexpensive or expensive rings, and they liked them more equally.
Hmm. Wow.
So what's your advice then for people that are giving gifts? What's the one thing they should keep in their minds as they brave the crowds in the shopping malls?
Yeah, well, maybe it's to not go to the shopping mall. Maybe it's to do something that's a little more thoughtful, a little more tailored to the recipient. And basically, you don't have to spend as much money as you think to get a thoughtful gift.
Great, Gabe. Yeah, tell on the business show, tell people not to go shopping. That's great.
Great for the economy.
Gabe Adams is a professor at London Business School and a researcher on the new study on gift giving. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Gabe.
No problem.
And finally this morning, Jeremy and Gabe, a 26-year-old man at an Austrian casino, he pulled the lever on a slot machine. This is a position you know very well, Jeremy. Don't you just park it on a stool?
Oh, yeah. I spend every afternoon in the slot houses of Commerce, California.
And up came a bunch of matching fruit on the screen. The lights all around him started flashing. The bells went off, and the machine exclaimed, "You won $60
million. $60
million. $60 million. Wow. Turns out, though, Jeremy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Only 4 of 5 fruit had lined up. And because of a software glitch, the machine thought that was the jackpot.
Uh-oh.
It wasn't the jackpot. supposedly. The machine said it was the jackpot, though. The man is suing, of course. Of course he's suing the casino because they won't honor the big prize. Instead, though, the casino did offer him about $100 and a free meal.
That's not quite the same as $60
million. $60 million, $100 for a free meal.
It depends on what the meal is, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's the buffet.
All you can eat buffet. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. Enjoy your Tuesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.